Now we turn to a fruit that so many of us take for granted, one that's more endangered every day.
Bananas are weird. They're weird to breed. Whether you're breeding them in a lab or in the field, bananas mutate quickly. And, you know, there has been experimentation with genetically modified bananas for more than a decade now.
Nearly 10 years ago now, I had a conversation with journalist Dan Capel. He's the author of a book called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. One of our topics was the common banana. It's called the Cavendish. And lately there are reports that its very existence is being threatened by a deadly fungus. I wanted to check in with Dan again about the latest efforts to save the banana. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. I'm so glad we're checking back in with each other 10 years later.
Me too.
So we were talking about the fungus then, and we're still talking about this fungus. What is it? What is the fungus that is stalking the Cavendish banana?
Well, the common name for it is Panama disease. The scientific name is Fusarium wilt tropical race 4. And when we first talked, we were speculating about where the fungus would go. It was in pretty limited areas, mostly in Asia. And we were wondering when it would come to Latin America, if it would come to Latin America. And since then, the fungus has spread to multiple continents. And just earlier this year, it appeared for the first time in Colombia, where it directly affects, for the first time, our banana supply in the United States.
So give us an idea of how important South America is to supplying America with the breakfast fruit.
Well, let's talk about South and Central America, which are, you know, connected. Every single banana we get, with maybe insignificant percentage coming from Mexico, and that's very rare. So basically, if you buy a banana anywhere in the continental United States, it came from South or Central America, period.
The world of bananas is huge. I mean, your book, for the most part, was on like the enormous biodiversity inherent in this genus. Why did we concentrate on this one variety and kind of put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak?
I think the best metaphor for that is to start with the understanding that a banana farm is not really a banana farm. It is a banana factory, or it's like a McDonald's. You're not going to see a lot of diversity coming out of a fast food restaurant. You're not going to see a lot of variety. The banana that we eat, the Cavendish, is an industrial product. And the supply chain is custom designed for just one kind of banana. Bananas ripen differently, different varieties. They taste different. They are shaped differently. They're fragile or they're not fragile. And so the entire banana supply chain, it's almost like a pipe coming from South America to the United States that only fits this one particular kind of banana, the Cavendish. And that's because the banana is so cheap, the margins are so thin that in order to make money, it's like the fast food business model. You just have to focus on cheap and actually not very good, just like the fast food business model.
It's so fascinating. So because of this, because of the unbelievable infrastructure that's been created around the banana, this variety of banana, to grow it and ship it up to us, it's better for the producers of the banana to now go heavily into technology to try and save it rather than to bring in or explore substituting other bananas that aren't affected by this fungus.
That's what the banana producers probably would like us all to think. You know, this is the second time the commercial banana, the single monoculture banana, has been affected by this fungus. An earlier variety called the Gros Michel was wiped out by a different variety of the fungus through the 1950s. The Cavendish replaced it, and now it's deeply, deeply threatened as well. This is a monoculture, and I think the time has come to stop looking at bananas as just one kind of fruit when there are thousands. I think the monoculture is environmentally devastating. It has a huge human cost in terms of pesticide use and the low margins that lead to labor exploitation. And it's also having a material cost in that it actually isn't working. I mean, twice now, the commercial banana has been threatened with extinction. Why are we going down the monoculture road again?
And yet we are humans and we are intensely curious and we love to tinker. So I now understand that CRISPR technology is being used to insert a gene that would do what?
So what we're trying to do, or what the scientists who are studying this, and I support their work, is to find a way to create resistance, either 100% resistance where the disease doesn't affect the banana, or increased immunity where the banana may survive in the field a few weeks, few months longer, so it can actually be picked. But, you know, it's problematic in a bunch of ways. One is that, you know, here in the United States, we're okay with GM because we probably don't know what food is and what food isn't. There are no labeling requirements. I personally don't think it's a problem, but there are people who do in Europe. I just was speaking to one of the banana scientists who's researching this yesterday, and he said, look, we're, you know, this is going to be really hard because legally we can't sell this in half the world. So I think it's possible that this will be successful. But the other half of this is that bananas are weird. They're weird to breed, whether you're breeding them in a lab or in the field. Bananas mutate quickly. And, you know, there has been experimentation with genetically modified bananas for more than a decade now. And when they get tested in the field, they don't seem to work as well. That's been pretty consistent. And bananas take a long time to breed. So even if you use CRISPR, which will shorten the process that will get us to field testing, once you're back out in the field, you're using conventional growing methods, the disease can spread conventionally, and who knows what's going to happen. So I think it's wrong to put all our bananas in one basket. I think GM bananas, CRISPR bananas will be successful ultimately in replacing the commodity Cavendish. But unless we use all the bananas at our disposal, the diversity, then I don't think it's going to be a long-term success. Maybe I won't live to see the failure of banana number 3, but I think it will fail.
So if you could pick a banana or a few bananas that you think can withstand the shipping requirements and the fickle tastes of the mass American and European markets, what would you nominate?
When we last talked, I lived in Southern California. We've since moved to Maine, and I took my kids apple picking the other day. And I was amazed. We had about, in one apple orchard, probably 15 varieties to choose from. Anybody who likes fruit or has looked at the fruit market in the United States knows that we've gone from a couple of basic commodity varieties with many different kinds of fruit to an incredible array of different choices, ranging from the commodity to very expensive ones. And that's a good thing. There are over 1,000 different breeds of banana. Now, all of them would present shipping challenges, but I would like to point out that when the Cavendish was adopted over the Gros Michel, many people, including the executives at Chiquita, said, we cannot ship the Cavendish. It's too difficult. It's too fragile. It ripens too quickly. That technological hurdle was overcome after some research. So I don't think there's any banana that's unshippable. It's just a matter of engineering. Now, which banana would I ship if I could? I can tell you for sure what it would be. It's a banana I tasted in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's called Ibota Ibota. The word Ibota means fertile in Swahili. So Ibota Ibota means really fertile. This banana has hundreds of fruit on a single tree. And the taste, I'm going to sound like a wine critic now. The taste is complex. It's sour, then it's sweet. It's a luscious honey sweetness, and the aroma from it is just magnificent. It tastes so good, and the texture is like super premium ice cream. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it, and it's such a good banana. It's going to be hard to ship because it bruises easily, but that is the banana I would love to see people taste, and I would love to taste again myself.
What does it look like?
It's shorter than our typical banana, fatter as well. It probably weighs about the same per fruit, but a little stubbier. But it's yellow. It ripens in a predictable way. Like I said, the bunches are quite large, sometimes up to 200 bananas at a time.
Wow.
Yeah, and our Cavendish can be 100 to 150. The banana trees are just a riot of fertility. It's great.
So having lived in Southern California, you know that many of us have banana trees in our front yards, banana trees that actually fruit and bear stalks of bananas. What are the chances of being able to get one's hands on a shoot of that African banana?
I can't say for sure that that's available, but there is a nursery, I think it's in San Diego, that specializes in different kinds of bananas. And they have an associated bulletin board at bananas.org, which is kind of a hobbyist website for banana geeks, I want to say, which I am one of them. That's not meant as pejorative. You can find pretty much any banana you want. When I lived in Mount Washington, I used to keep a record of all the bananas I'd pass on my walks or runs. And what most people forget to do is to harvest them. Bananas don't really start to ripen until you take them off the tree. So if you're listening to this in Southern California, you've got an interesting banana or an unknown banana in your yard. When it gets looking pretty yellow or pretty green, take it off the tree and let it ripen and then taste it. You might be surprised.
It's always so great to talk to you. Thank you so much for checking in with us.
My pleasure.
I've been talking with Dan Capel about the race to save the Cavendish banana. He's the author of a book called Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. For Lifelong Angelenos, eating an original Tommy's chili burger under the glow of a fluorescent street lamp at midnight is practically a rite of passage. Maybe even more so than In-N-Out. But drive around L.A. and you'll see more imitators than the original article. How did they come to be? I'm talking with L.A. Times reporter Daniel Miller when we return.